Special Committee on Budget. This is the Subcommittee on Education and Natural Resources. It's Monday, June 13th, 2005, and we're here for a public hearing and work session on House Bill 2450. I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2450. Ms. McGlashan, can you take us through the overview of the work that we're going to be doing today?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members of the subcommittee, you have before you House Bill 2450 in its original form. And this was introduced at the request of the Oregon School Boards Association and the Confederation of School Administrators. It comes to you from the House Revenue Committee. The bill makes the high cost disabilities account and the small school district supplement fund permanent components of the state school fund distribution formula. And both of these were added to the formula by the 2003 legislature, and they are set to expire on June 30th, 2005. And I would point out that there were -2 amendments to 2450 that were adopted by the House Revenue Committee, but there was a little bit of a mix-up in the paperwork, and so that has resulted in the original bill coming to you instead of an engrossed version. So you have before you some -12 amendments to 2450, and basically what these amendments do is they incorporate the -2 amendments that the House Revenue Committee intended to adopt, or did adopt and intended to have amended into the bill, and these provisions start on about page 10 of the -12 amendments. And I've distributed for you the revenue impact, by the way, on the original bill, just for your background information. And then the other thing that these amendments do is they pretty much place the engrossed version of House Bill 3460, which is the Speaker Stability Plan for K-12, into the bill, and that's in about the first 10 pages of the -12 amendments.
Thank you. At this point, a couple of courtesies. First of all, our thanks to Representative Butler for joining us here today. Representative Butler had this bill in the Revenue Committee and is very familiar with it, and we thank you for taking time out of your schedule to join us today.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate
being here. And I'd like to also welcome the Speaker of the House. It's an honor to have you before our committee, and I would ask you to please come forward and talk to us about the -12 amendments to House Bill 2450.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Karen Menace, Speaker of the House, representing House District 49. I want to thank the committee this morning for entertaining these amendments that are before you and to be incorporated into House Bill 2450. This bill is before you, these amendments in particular are before you, because in March I was sitting in my office watching the 5 o'clock news and watching the predicament that our school system has fallen into. I've watched over 20 years in this process as education funding has become a bidding war. There seems to be no rhyme nor reason. We have gone through 6 tumultuous years in our revenues in the state through a very difficult time and gone through this recession. And our schools have been impacted as a result of that. Watching the madness, I said enough is enough. And I called Paul Warner into my office. And I asked Paul if we could get this done, if we could accomplish this. I would be interested in finding a way to dedicate funding for K-12 in the state of Oregon so our school children would not have to be loaded on buses and hauled to the state capitol and made to plead for their education, but it is something that they could rely on from biennium to biennium. Parents could go to work instead of coming down here, assuming that we somehow have a pot of gold sitting around that we somehow just don't want to give to their kids for their education. I believe it is time to put education first, and in that, take the bold step of dedicating funds towards that end. The stability plan would take 51% of the income tax that is collected and dedicated strictly for K-12. The 51% would then be used in this manner. 9% above, we start at 5.318 would be the beginning point of the bill. and we would assume a 9% roll-up cost. I have a cold, excuse me. For operation costs. If the economy grows more than 9%, anything that would come in over the top of that 9%, one-third, would go towards the Successful Schools Plan, which would be a grant program administered by the Oregon Department of Education to help struggling schools and also to encourage innovation by successful schools. There would be criteria that is set out in the bill that would need to be met, and the schools could apply, I think, every two years, I think, is what they settled on in the committee. The other two-thirds of the amount over the 9% would go into a rainy day fund, and Paul Warner will distribute for you kind of the outlook and how quickly that rainy day fund grows. He even shows if we hit a recession, how much money would be projected at if we're projecting about a 12% increase per biennium. There would be a significant set aside strictly for K-12, and that would help bolster schools during the time of a recession. I think having a strong school system would encourage people to come to Oregon, businesses to locate in Oregon. I know our school system is, and our education system is one of the things they look at when they decide whether or not this is a good place to come and move their families and raise their children. I think it's past time that we take a step back at how we've done business over many decades in the state and how we fund our kids, how we fund their education. I would like it if we could come into session and talk policy. What are we teaching our kids rather than how are we going to spend the money or how much money are we going to raise? Let's talk about what policy we implement and how we can do the very best job we know to do. And what kind of courses do we teach? And look, focus on that rather than a dollar amount. The effort in these, in this bill and in these particular amendments is to stabilize our schools, have some predictability, allow school boards to set out a plan, long-term plans, and a fixed plan. So when they're deliberating as to how to allocate their resources, they can have an ability to look out 6-8 years and to be able to plan accordingly, knowing they're going to have a steady flow of income coming into them. And they can anticipate needs and do long-term, long-range planning in their allocation of resources. I think it's time we do. This is a bold step. I think it's time that we took a bold step and changed the way we've been doing business in regards to how we're educating the children in the state and how we pay for that education. With that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Madam Speaker, I would like to thank you for bringing this concept forward. I think that in the four sessions that I've been in the building, the debate around K-12 has really eclipsed any, the debate around the funding has eclipsed the debate around the policy, and that putting this formula in place will give the district certainty. And over my tenure in this process, I've heard a lot of discussion around the importance of certainty in terms of districts' ability to be able to budget and deal with staffing issues and services and supply issues in a realistic kind of a way. So I think that this is an outstanding concept from that point of view alone. The rainy day fund, I think that the 3 years that we've just been through point out the need to be able to maybe shave the tops off the revenue peaks in order to shave the bottoms off of the revenue troughs, and trying to even out that revenue flow using rainy day funds is a worthwhile thing for the state of Oregon. We also have had very clear dialogue with the financial markets about the need for Oregon to have rainy day funds in order for our bond ratings to be reasonable and to be a good place for people to invest in that arena. the successful schools piece is something that I've been very intrigued with for a long time. I think that there are clear policy initiatives that people in this building are interested in that would be to the long-term betterment of the quality of education that we provide students in the K-12 system. And to be able to use a portion of funding or to have a fund set aside to deal with those issues will give us a place to go in the policy discussions that we haven't had before. And I think that that is in the long-term best interest of the state and the K-12 system too. So thank you so much for your thought on this. I think that this is indeed a huge breakthrough for us in this discussion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to also recognize the work of the House Revenue Committee and Representative Butler in particular, who heads up that committee and also headed up a work group that met quite often on this bill, trying to put the pieces in place, and I think they've done an exemplary job, and I just wanted to say on the record how much I appreciate Representative Butler's efforts and that of his committee, and thus you have their work product before you this morning.
Thank you.
Questions?
Representative Schaffler.
More comments than anything, and it's nice to have the speaker before us, out of her office, among us, breathing air. You know, North Clackamas is budgeting, David Douglas School District is budgeting at $5.2 billion right now, and they're adding a full, everyone's going to go to kindergarten all day, which they haven't been doing. I met with Ron Naso, the superintendent of North Clackamas, and Joe Crum, their public relations, before the session started, and they said 5.318 would keep them where they are, which is they do need more than that, but at least keep them where they are. So I'm interested in this. But my real comment is, Madam Chair, we do have a pot of gold out there, and we can get 9% growth in this state. It's through flexible land use, taking advantage of our natural resources, making a very serious commitment, especially us stop running around saying it's a bad place to invest. I think we all have to quit saying that. Making a serious commitment that Oregon's serious about investment in the state. That's going to get us more than $5.4 billion. And I don't think there's anything you're saying we've got to keep it at 51%. Is there? We could, if we were overflowing with money, we'd go under the rainy day fund. Could we add onto the 51%? Is there anything precluding us from doing that?
There is not. There is actually a provision to come back and examine the plan in four years.
All right.
And make adjustments if needs be at that time.
But, Madam Chair, if I may, that's just what I wanted to say. We got the money in this state. We got the wealth in this state. We just need to go get it. It's laying out there on the ground. And I've said that repeatedly in this committee and the Natural Resources Committee.
Representative Schaffler, I would agree.
Thank you.
I think we blocked up a lot of those natural resources that could certainly contribute to the wealth of the state.
I agree with you, Representative Schaffler, and I appreciate you bringing the point forward. And it also is gratifying to have members of the education community that understand the hydraulic of creating wealth in this state also. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. And Madam Speaker, Madam Chairman, and Madam Speaker, if I get myself straightened out here this morning someplace along the way, I too appreciate the thought that you put into this, the work that you've put into this, and the effort of the Revenue Committee and the work that they've done. I know it's been a fairly long process as far as they're concerned. I do have, at the risk of sounding perhaps more conservative than I really fashion myself to be, a little bit of concern about the what I thought I heard you saying, and I was trying to read through here very quickly, and I hadn't found it, but what I thought I heard you saying about schools who were non-performing, that there'd be if we were over a certain amount, there would be money that would be available, for that. One of the things, Madam Speaker, I'm sure, I I don't, in my own humble estimation, and I apologize for this, but I don't think you take poor performing schools and throw money at them and make them good performing schools. I have real concern about just throwing money out there because a school is not performing well without there being some mechanism looking at the structure of what's going on in those schools to be looking, I mean, to find out what's causing the poor performance, if you may.
You will see some language in there that they set out a certain criteria and they have to meet certain benchmarks in order to be eligible for that, and I think that language is in the bill, and that was written with the cooperation of Oregon Department of Education.
Thank you, Madam Judge. Appreciate that.
Further comments for the speaker? Thank you very much.
Thank
we
you.
Really appreciate your time today. At this point, I would like to call Paul Warner forward to take us through the provisions of the Dash 12s. Good morning, Mr. Warner. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Paul Warner, Legislative Revenue Office. I was going to walk through the 3460 elements of the bill, and I prepared a sheet that probably a lot of you have seen. We have a copy of this.
We do not have that. We do have that. We just don't exactly have it.
And this is the kind of the worksheet that the House Revenue Committee worked through and the work group prior to that. And it just lays out the mechanics of how the Dash 12s would work, the 3460 elements of that. The key assumptions, as the speaker laid out, first of all, I've started this at 0507 at 5.2. That's just a plug number to give you some percentages. Of course, that will be decided here in the next couple of weeks what that number will be. The key policy numbers in the bill, though, are 51% of personal income tax collections. Secondly, that when the 0709 calculation is made, which is when the bill takes effect, it is based on the assumption that there was 5.318 allocated in 0507. So, in other words, there's a 9% growth rate, and that 9% refers back to 5318. You'll see some language in the bill that refers to the School Revenue Forecast Committee and that in their December report, and that was the number that they used. So regardless of what decision you make on what the state school fund will be in 0507, if this bill is in effect, it will use 5318 as a starting point. Excess of 9% growth will be divided one-third to successful schools, as the speaker laid out, and that is capped at 2% of the state school fund, and then two-thirds will go to the Education Stability Fund. So I'll walk through the columns with you to show you how this would work. Now, these are trend projections. This is based on the May revenue forecast, and then I've extended that out a couple of biennium. If you look at the 0709 projection, you see that the personal income tax collections are estimated to be $11,355,000,000. That's a growth of 12.1%. That, by the way, is traditionally about what we've thought is the long-term growth rate, about 6% a year, 12.1% for the biennium.
Come in, Chair.
Representative Shaw.
So, are you on the trend projection adjustment page or the cyclical projection with adjustment page?
Representative Shaw, I'm on the trend.
Okay. And then show me right where you got that number.
I'm in column 3, 0709.
Okay. All right, now I'm with you.
Okay, I've got 11,355 is the forecast. Now, if I take 51% of that, I get 5,791. Okay, so that's the amount that would be dedicated under this bill.
Representative March.
Thank you. And you're using these projections based on the current tax model, not including capital gains cuts, other federal tax connections.
That's correct, Representative March. I'm basing this on the May current law revenue forecast.
So if the capital gains cut that we passed out of the House is passed by the legislature, these numbers would go down.
That's correct. Anything that reduces the personal income tax number, you're taking 51% of a smaller base. There is language in the review that the speaker referred to, a review every 4 years that the legislature is to do. There's also language that says if there are significant changes in income tax law or other factors. So that's how it refers to it in the bill. But anything that reduces the personal income tax...
Could you restate that, what you just said about significant changes?
Madam Chair, it's on page 3, item 7B at the bottom of the page. What's significant?
So, but that what a significant change in income tax law would do is trigger a review in the formula for this.
Madam Chair, if I may, with Paul's indulgence as well, we had discussed anything that would change that 101%, which would be anything in the vicinity of $10 million, changes of $10 million or more, should require some kind of a change. Now that we didn't patent the 1/100 of 1% in code, we felt like that. In other words, until you get to 101%, it's really not calculable at all when we sit down to make those calculations. And these are based upon projections and the best of circumstances. So that was the kind of the feeling of the Legislative Revenue Committee, that when there were those kinds of changes, and recognize that for the 0507, with regard to the capital gains tax, there is no effect in 0507, but for 0709, I think there would have been 3 or 4 one-hundredths of 1%, which would then allow you to come back in and say, should you then adjust the 51% to 51.05 in order to recapture that?
I see. Okay. Thank you. Please proceed, Mr. Warner.
Okay. Madam Chair, so again, going down this column, now if I take the 5318 and multiply by 9% or allow 9% growth, then I actually get 5797. So I get a little bit more than the 51% dedication. So it's constrained to 51%. So that would be the top number that would be calculated first. Now there is in the bill, there is an exception that's stated that if the 51% calculation gives you less than the 9% growth, then the Education Stability Fund can be tapped. Now, there's two situations, a Representative Shoffler situation where we get stronger growth from the change of policy or whatever, the 51% will pick up the same percentage of a bigger number. But if you have the 51% getting a smaller number in a recession, for example, then the Education Stability Fund could be used to bump it above 51%.
And for the record, what are the requirements to actually tap into the Education Stability Fund?
Madam Chair, the requirements are that the legislature make a finding, and those are in order language, that if employment declines for 6 months or more, then there can be a finding that the fund can be tapped, or if the revenue forecast is more than 2% below the close of session. Now, regardless of what the finding is, it takes a 3/5 vote.
And is there not also an emergency trigger that can be used there, too, that requires a different path?
That's correct, Madam Chair. The governor can declare an emergency for reasons unrelated to the specific finding wording, but that still takes a 3/5. So the 3/5 is always required.
Thank you. Please proceed.
So I have assumed that the legislature would stay at the 5791, which is the 51%, and then you would have our local revenue projection, which I have assumed property taxes grow about 4.5% or 9% for the biennium. That would give you $2,825,000,000. Now notice the 0507 local revenue growth is higher, but that's because of the common school fund distribution. That's what pushed that up to 11% growth this coming biennium. So your total school operating revenue under the scenario for the current forecast would be $8,616,000,000, a growth of 10.6% from 0507, again assuming you have $5.2 billion allocated this biennium. Now there is no excess dollars left over because the 51% absorbs the entire amount of the 9% growth absorbs the entire 51% dedication. So you don't have additional allocations to the Successful Schools Fund or the Stability Fund. The bottom line here on the Stability Fund is the projected growth from lottery revenue. That's just your 18% going into the Stability Fund. Now you don't have any additional allocation coming from income taxes. 09-11, the forecast is for trend growth to continue at 12.5%. Again, this is the May projection. Now, if I take 51% of that, I'm at 6515 for the in terms of the amount of dollars going to K-12, but 9% growth, and I've used the higher number, this 5797, to get that 9% growth, gives you 6312. So now you have some excess dollars between the 9% growth and the 51% dedication. And that's where you get into this two-third, one-third allocation. One-third going to the Successful Schools Fund of $67 million, and two-thirds going to the Stability Fund for $136 million. Again, you've got projected local operating revenue growth of 9%. Now, we expect that to be fairly stable, but still there'll be fluctuations on that, and that I'll get to that in the cyclical scenario in a minute. So you have 9% growth overall in operating revenue, but when you add in the $67 million from the Successful Schools Fund, you have 9.8% biennial growth for dollars, current dollars available to schools. You have also added $136 million to the Stability Fund. Now, the Education Stability Fund is capped at 5% of the prior biennium general fund revenue. So once it goes above 5%, then it goes into a separate sub-account called the School Capital Matching Sub-Account. And you'd actually hit that 5% target under these projections in 09-11. By the way, these stability funds allocations would be at the end of the biennium, so you'd be talking about July of 2011. So there's you'd be at the 5% at $632 million. Now, by the way, the House Revenue Committee does have a Senate joint resolution that would bump that to 10%. That may come in as a factor in your decisions. The school capital matching sub-account then would have $96 million. That doesn't have any current criteria. You'd have to establish criteria for how that's to be allocated, so you'd have to have some implementing legislation for that. So now if we continue out under this projected trend growth, you can see that our 51% growth, because income taxes are growing well in excess of 9%. So you're putting additional dollars in the Successful Schools Fund, and by the year 2013-15, you've hit the 2% cap, $150 million. And you're also putting a substantial amount into the Education Stability Fund, $354 million in 2013-15. But you're growing, your operating revenue is growing right around 9% because you have the 9% income tax dedication, and you have 9% assumed local property tax growth. But your overall school dollars are growing about 9.5% with the Successful Schools Fund. And notice that the Stability Fund is growing very rapidly. So you have a large Stability Fund under these trend projections. Now, the trend scenarios are designed to reflect long-term patterns and are reasonable assumptions in terms of the growth we'd expect over, say, a 20-year period. But I think very few people in this room would think it a safe assumption we wouldn't have a recession by the year 2013-15. Probably well over 95% chance we'll have one by then. So what I tried to do is look at a typical recession. There's not really...
May I ask one question before you flip the page over? The revenue that's in the Education Stability Fund balance on this spreadsheet, does it also reflect the lottery dollars that go in here?
Yes, Madam Chair. That's why you've got the growth. With the 0507 at the end of the biennium, $201 million, that's all lottery dollars.
Thank you.
So you wouldn't start putting anything in until 0911.
Representative Schaffer.
Mr. Werner, you dial in inflation, and then on the next side you're going to put a potential recession. You also consider the increasingly unstable financial situation that the federal government is just diving into. Is that, does that go into your calculations?
Representative Schaffer, it does only in the sense of how it would affect long-run growth in the economy. If federal fiscal policy through large deficits has a potential to create instability, and how that would affect us is lower our income tax growth or increase inflation, which would mean that our income tax, the growth we get, we wouldn't be able to buy as much. But these are all trend projections based on the assumption that the deficit slowly declines, that we tend to grow about 2.5% in real terms over time, and we continue to see a long-term inflation environment around 3% a year. Those are the long-term projections. Again, that's a very tidy scenario, and we know that there's a lot of risk to that. So again, this gets back to looking at how this kind of a how this proposal would operate under what would be a normal recession or a typical recession. We do think that the 2001-03 recession was atypical. I mean, the drops, in, not in terms of the economy so much, but the drops of revenue were, and we've talked about this a lot, were unprecedented in the post-war period. So we would expect something to be less severe than that, but still possibly significantly different than what that trend shows.
Yeah, the drop was unusual. Also, the trend upward in the 90s was incredibly unusual.
Yes.
So I think that they go together, the unusual rise in revenue and the incredible drop in revenue.
You're exactly right, Representative Schaffer.
Representative March.
Yes. You're mentioning trends and inflation. Have the cost trends related to education spending, and minus the shift of the spending to the state, but just the basic costs. Have you developed a trend line for those? For example, insurance this time I think has gone up in the 11 to 13 range, and we've had PERS rates go up, considerably. Have you calculated that? What part inflation in the education realm is related to the inflation in the income?
Representative Marks, there's two elements here. One is we would expect that the general inflationary trends would be related to income tax growth in a general kind of way. For example, in the 70s, we had a biennia where our income tax grew 40%. And of course, a lot of that was due to the inflation that existed at that time. So the income tax picks up that general inflation. But the education-specific components, and in particular, there's a lot of discussion in the House Revenue Committee about the PERS calculations, especially in the 07-09 biennium. And those are likely to push cost growth above what the trend growth would be for education costs. So the answer is that we would expect cost growth to be above its long-term trend over the next couple of biennia. In terms of whether we actually do resolve some of the issues around benefit costs, I think you can make the case that would mean severe problems for the entire economy if there's not something done in terms of limiting that kind of growth, because it's reflective of something endemic in the whole economy. But we have not accounted for that special factor in 07-09, but it was one of the factors that went into the discussion of the work group to start at 5318, arguing that, okay, we start from a higher level, then you at least somewhat count for that anticipated above-average growth in 07-09.
Mr. Warner, with relation to the inflation factors in the cost of health insurance for the employees in the system, how are you seeing those inflationary increases trend over time? My understanding is that we're seeing some moderation in that rate. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
We would suspect that would be the case because, you know, over time, it's... the economy simply can't absorb those kinds of growth in healthcare costs, or all of us are going to be working in the healthcare sector. So at some point there has to be some cost containment, some limitations on that growth. What we have looked at and projected out longer term through this pattern is what the private wage forecasts are. And those tend to average, in the May revenue forecast, tend to average 4 to 4.5% a year, which would put you in the 8 to 9% range per biennium. So we think that's what would be a long-term driver of education costs would be the growth in private wages, because that's really what's going to determine education costs as labor costs. And ultimately, there has to be a linkage between those costs and the private sector costs. So admittedly, it's loose, and there are a lot of periods when one will be higher than the other, but over time, we would suspect that would be the key driver.
Representative March.
So to follow up on that, if we're projecting an 8 to 9% labor cost in the long term, and we're basing our growth here on a straight 9% for the most part, we haven't got any accounting in there for population growth in the schools. So in other words, more children, and these things tend to go up and down a little bit as baby boomers we are. I don't see anything in here for that, for population growth.
We have also looked at the growth in the weighted student count. And we are in a period now, and we think it will last for at least another 5 years or so, where our 5 to 17-year-old population is growing very slowly. And that should be less than actually about 1% per biennium is what we assume. And now you can double that to give you a rough estimate of weighted students, because we have those categories like ELL populations that are growing much more rapidly. So that would be another 2%. Now, one thing to keep in mind about wage growth, and I know it's very difficult in the public sector in general and certainly in education, but when we say 4 to 4.5% growth in the private sector wages, that would include a component for productivity gains. I mean, we assume the productivity rises over time so that, you know, the 4 to 4.5% is not all cost to the employer. The employer is getting an increased output per hour.
And increased output per hour for teachers would mean more students per teacher.
Well, that's, I would think it, to me anyway, and I think in theory it would mean better quality education. Now, how that would work itself out is you know, a complex issue. But in turn, it would mean a better product is what it would mean. And that's, of course, what you spend a lot of time on.
It could just as easily translate, Representative March, into students moving through the process more expeditiously and coming out of it needing less remediation at the next level. I mean, there are a number of ramifications here that could make the system more productive.
But that's a very complicated area. If I could look then at the cyclical projections, I've kept the same assumptions through 2007-09, and then in 2009-11, I've assumed that we get hit by a pretty severe recession. And instead of having growth of 12.5% in 2009-11 in the personal income taxes, we get 4% growth. So we still have some positive growth, which is we didn't have in 2001-03, by the way. We were... we declined in terms of our collections compared to the prior biennium. But as Representative Shoffer pointed out, we don't anticipate the stock market bubble again. So that's what caused a lot of our losses. But if we had 4% growth, very likely you will be back in here in special session at least once, because that would be a severe drop-off in what we would anticipate. So in this case, your 51% dedication then gives you less than 9% growth. So you get $6,023,000,000, and to get your 9%, you need $6,312,000,000. So what happens is the assumption would be you would meet in special session, get a three-fifths vote, and allocate $289 million out of the stability fund to bump you up to the 6312. Now, when you do the projection for the next biennium for 9% growth, instead of using the 6023 for your 9% calculation, you use the 6312. Now, the reason for that is so you don't have this ratcheting down effect that you talked about in terms of spending limits.
Again, another global question. The local operating revenue that's generated for the system, if I'm on this concept correctly, that isn't part of the computation at all. That just is whatever happens.
That is correct, Madam Chair. The local operating revenue gets added into overall revenue and run through the formula, but it's not affected by this.
And over time, when you take a look at the local revenue, which is predominantly based on property tax revenues, what do you see trending there?
One of the effects of Measure 50 has been to add a lot more stability to the local revenue and local property tax projections. So I've assumed this 4.5% a year, 9% growth. But in this recession, I assume that drops to 5%. Kind of the rule of thumb we've used is over time, if you grow 4.5%, you get about 2.5% from existing property, 2.5 to 3%, and then the remainder is from new construction. So in a recession, you'd see that new construction drop off. You would see a lot of commercial and industrial property that's still assessed at market value. That could decline. And so you could get below that trend. But Measure 50 has limited that the range in which property taxes can move around. And if you look at the last recession, of course, it was unusual in terms of the real estate industry, but we saw very little drop off in property taxes.
So is it a fair statement that the probably of all the moving parts that there are that fund schools, the local property tax revenue stream is one of the least volatile?
That's correct, Madam Chair. It is certainly the most stable. There is one exception, though, and that would be if we were to move in 70-style recession or 70-style inflation, because you're limited to 3% a year. So, you know, if you think back on the 70s, we were seeing, you know, property values growing, you know, 10 to 15% a year, mostly inflationary increases. The 3% cap is not adjusted for inflation. So that could really put a lot of, would create enormous problems for local governments and for school districts, too.
Representative March.
Actually, you've raised a lot of interesting questions there. In the 80s, there was an actual real estate decline, and there's been some analysis that we're currently in a real estate bubble right now. So if we hit a real estate decline like we did in the 80s, I presume that we would drop below the 5% growth in property values, or at least property tax collections.
Mm-hmm. You're right, Representative March. There's been a lot of discussion. Even the Chairman Greenspan has talked about this and about the risk. And there is debates about how severe that risk is. But again, Measure 50 would come in and soften a lot of that, because if you're, you know, a lot of the residential property, particularly in the metro area, is its assessed value is 75% of its market value. So even if its market value declines 10%, you're still going to get that 3% growth, because you're going to be well below the market value.
with the possible exception of collections, because collections tend to drop when property values decline, and particularly if you're doing 100% interest financing at this particular juncture, which some people are.
That's true, and also the other exception I mentioned was on the commercial industrial property, which is at market value. That's going to start dropping, and we've seen that to some extent in some depressed industries now. So there's certainly some downside risk, and that's why I plugged in this 5%, which would be a significant drop off in rates of growth here. But still, it's not as the downward risk is not as much as it was in the pre-measure 50 days.
Representative Schaffler had a question.
Editorial, not a question. If we get rid of the ridiculous double majority and quit rewarding those that are too lazy to vote, local governments and local school districts could have a better control of their destiny. My question, though, Mr. Warner, thank you for indulging me, Madam Chair. My question for Mr. Warner is
aware that my indulgence only goes so far.
Yes, ma'am, I understand. Thank you. I appreciate it. I do. You'd go from 4% in 2009-11 to 18% in 2011-13. Since the recession's flattened out, what has the annual growth been? Right now, just the recent history, what has the annual growth been?
Well, you can see the 2005-2007 projection is 12.6%. Our 2003-2005 is above that, but 2001-2003 was very low, but it was also artificially low because we did allocate a 2% kicker refund in 2001-2003 as well. So if you look historically, you see a lot of fluctuations caused by the kicker. So as we're looking out, of course, we don't assume any kickers. So you get a little bit more stable growth. But the growth in the 90s, even with the kicker in place, in 95-97 and 93-95 exceeded 20%. The personal income tax.
Madam Chair, a question on the lottery projections. This is really, I mean, in 10 years you see it quadrupling, the lotto revenue, from $201 million to $781 million. That's a real steep.
Representative Schaffer, remember what you've done with the Education Stability Fund. Basically, you just started it. And then used most of the projected revenue this biennium to balance your state school fund budget. So the fund has gotten very low. In fact, it's the only thing in it basically is the Oregon Growth Account, which is a neighborhood of 20 to 25 million. So you're going from a very low level now, and this is the projected amount going in the coming biennium, is about 180 million. So then you add another about $190 million and so on. So then you see that the percentage increase is high because we're starting from virtually nothing.
Representative March.
Yes, in your cyclical projection of 2009-11, you're showing a $289 million coming out of the school education stability fund. Does that require a three-fifths vote, or would that be automatic?
Representative Mars, that would require a three-fifths vote. Now, what you have in this this two-third allocation of the excess, that's a statutory revenue source. So the amount of revenue you put in through that source, you could change statutorily. But once the money is in the fund, and Cindy will tell you, once it's in the fund, it's constitutional. So then you're back to the triggers that access the fund. Now, the one thing that the bill does is it sets up a separate sub-account of the stability fund that is the dollars that flow through this mechanism can only be used for K-12. And the existing education stability fund, the general lottery stability fund, can be used for all education.
So you would be tracking the two components of the Education Stability Fund separately?
That's correct. Would be treated as a sub-account.
You could tap the lottery fund revenue stream for K-12 if we chose to, but we could also tap that for the other components of education.
That's correct. The other difference with the sub-account, the K-12 sub-account, is unlike the larger fund, the lottery source, it retains its own interest earnings.
So there would be faster growth in terms of that sub-account.
Please proceed.
Okay. I'll finish up quickly, Madam Chair. So you're withdrawing $289 million, and of course what that does is lower your balance on the stability fund. But by withdrawing that $289 million, you're able to have overall operating revenue growth of 7.7%. So one of the key elements to this, implementing a plan like this, would be when that next recession hits.
And you would continue to grow the base.
Yes.
You wouldn't be decreasing the base because you had a revenue decrease.
Right. This issue has come up, for example, in the Colorado spending limit, where revenues drop off, and if you lower that base, then you're going to grow at a lower base, and mm-hmm. you have this ratcheting down effect. The way this bill is written, the state school fund calculation is off of a certain base, and the 9% calculation grows from that base, regardless of what happens to the revenue. So then, of course, you don't meet the cap in 2009-11 as you did under the other scenario, but then I've assumed you come back to 18% growth, so 22% for the two biennials around the long-term average, and then you start putting dollars back into the Successful Schools Fund and the Education Stability Fund after that next biennium, and you can see that the projected growth for schools, including the Successful Schools Fund, is 10.4%. So you get the stability component really through two elements. One is the use of the stability fund itself, but the other is through this 9% and that 9% base. So you would assume over time you would have more stability in the state school fund and less stability in terms of the Successful Schools Fund, because that comes out of the excess.
Out of that.
Yes. So that gives you a sense of how it would operate in a recession scenario.
Representative March.
Thank you. Do you have a sort of idea of what our personal income tax projected growth has been over, say, the last five biennium?
We have Representative March. You know, when I was forecasting revenue for the state, even going back to the 90s, we assumed there was a 12% trend. So that trend really hasn't changed over the last 15 years, what we think about a 5 to 6%, around 6% annual growth. And that tends to be based on the assumption that you have, you know, a 3% annual inflation environment, and you have real growth of about 3%, half of which is population growth. The other half is through real per capita growth. So those kinds of basic numbers have been in place. In the 90s, when you take out the effects of the kickers and the fluctuations that caused, our income tax growth was right around 10% a year. So that was pretty remarkable, particularly given the low inflation environment that we had. Now, of course, we know that certainly a chunk of that, and we think as much as $750 million in 99-01, was due to the stock market bubble. That was not sustainable. But still, we had significant wage growth and the other components of income. So we were looking at growth of, without the stock market, 8% a year. We don't think that's going to return. We think that the 6% trend growth is probably a reasonable assumption. But you can also come up with a lot of plausible reasons why you may have a lower trend, and things like the foreign trade deficit, for example, and adjustments that's going to require, or the federal deficit. So there's a lot of reasons that could push us below trend for an extended period.
Mr. Warner, we've had a lot of discussion, in fact, some very grand discussions, around how education is the foundation that we have, that we're building for the future, but that it's not the whole house, and that we've got a lot of other policy areas and programs that the state finances that make this the kind of place that Oregonians want to live in. Talk to us about the impact on the rest of the budget that this will have.
Madam Chair, I think that there's a couple of things that for context. One is, if you look back historically, the growth rate of the personal income tax has exceeded the growth rate of the general fund. If you go way back to the 60s, for example, personal income taxes were about two-thirds of the general fund. So that has steadily grown. And now, by the time you get into 05, 07, it's about 90%. So we're seeing the personal income tax rise as a share of the general fund revenue. So if you keep the current configuration of the general fund, and there's no additions of revenue, then you would see, under this plan, the state school fund rise as a share of the general fund. Well, that would put some additional pressure on some of those other components. The other issue is, if you look at the demographics and if you look at some of the cost drivers that you're familiar with, and certainly in this committee, you can see definitely some higher growth rates in some of these, certainly in terms of demand for services. We talked about the school age population is relatively flat. Higher ed population has gone through rapid growth as the 18 to 24 segment has grown rapidly. And then, of course, the senior population we expect to really take off in the next 10 years as the baby boomers age and begin to move in. But although the real impact on the budget for that group doesn't really start to occur until they get 75 plus. And that's where we'll really start to see some pressure. So there are some of the, and of course the inmate population is another one you're very, very familiar with, has grown rapidly as the long-term effects of Measure 11 come into play. So these other components of the budget cost drivers are going to be, make it very competitive in the general fund. So in terms of the school's perspective under current law, they would get a higher share of general fund under our current projections, given these assumptions.
Okay. Representative Schaffler, I believe you had a question.
Historically, I guess we just have to go back to Measure 5, because that's really when it changed. What percentage of personal income tax revenue has went into K-12?
The percentage of personal income tax revenue that goes into the K-12 has, of course, rose dramatically following Measure 5, and it did peak at about 57-58%, began dropping down.
What year was that, please? Off the top of your head, if you can.
The peak, I believe, was in 97-99, I believe. But I do have that chart, and I can get that for you, Representative Schaffler. But the percentage, and you can look at the percentage here on your chart, and 49.16 is a percentage of 89.94. You can see that it is higher than 51% that period. So historically, it has been above 51% over the last three or four biennium.
Okay, and Representative March has a question, and then Representative Jones.
Paul, I was going back over, trying to figure out, this 109%, and which is 4.5 annually, basically, how that fit into the history. And from 1948 through 1992, the annual audited current operating expenditures changed, never once dropped to 4.5%. The closest it came was in 82-83, which was 4.6%, and next was 84-85, which was 4.9%. And you've got double digit in some of those years, all the way up till, of course, once you got into Measure 5, it shifted the thing, and we were in a state of flux at that time. But even in that period, we've had probably a little more than 4.5% growth. And so I'm concerned that our limit there is going to cause some extreme squeeze on the school districts over time. So could you comment on that?
A couple of things. One is, as we look ahead, and we've come through the experience of 0103, and I have a general fund chart that goes back to 1931, and you know, you can see that, that the growth in the general fund is remarkable over that time. I mean, we've consistently had general fund growth in the 15 to 20% range, and that was reflected in that, that growth. And then, as I said earlier, the old 103 decline, which ultimately was about 8%, 7.5%, and that was with the bond sale that you had at the end of the biennium, or it would have been about 13%. So the question is, you know, how reflective of that is that of what the future is going to bring? If we go back to a period of stronger growth, more reflective of our post-war history, then I think that this plan would do a couple of things. One is, remember that the first calculation you do off of this plan is the 51%. So if we do return to a period of stronger growth, or even higher inflation, more in-migration, you're picking up 51% of a bigger number. So what's going to happen is that excess, the 9% and the 51%, will grow significantly over time. Mechanically, the first thing you would do is fill up this successful schools fund, this 2% cap would be reached. And once you do that, and you can notice that, that in my trend projection, I didn't point this out, I should have, in 2013-15, you're at the 150 cap, and then you've got 24 over that, and that goes back into the state school fund under the bill. So you would start to put money back in through that route if you get stronger growth. The other thing I suspect is would happen with the stability fund, and if you see a big growth in the stability fund, there's likely to be, this is a statutory revenue source, and that revenue source could be cut off if the stability fund has grown to a level that people feel is adequate.
Follow up, then, I mean, looking at the worst recession years of the in the past, I mean, what was 76, 78, they were at 8% growth. 71, 2, 5.9% growth.
Keep in mind, that's a period of much higher inflation, particularly the later 70s.
Right, but we're also now dealing with, we're coming in at a low point for schools right now. Even at 5.318, we're nowhere near the quality education model. And we're nowhere near getting 90% of the kids, let alone 100% of the kids, leaving no child behind. So if we're starting out at this point, we're so far behind, and we're never going to get caught up, is what I
said. Senator March, respectfully, I think that you're into a kind of a policy judgment question here that is not appropriate for the fiscal officer or the revenue officer to discuss. So with that, Representative Jensen, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I realize that all of the calculations get somewhat thrown askew when we get to dollar measure 5. But have you made the hypothetical assumption that this plan would have been in operation and effective in the 99-01 session, and then with the known variable or the known inflation, deflation, and general fund values run out the projection, or not then the projections, but what would have been the actual data?
I have, Representative Jensen. You know, the short answer is you don't get a very good fit historically because, as you said, Measure 5 created. You know, if you look at the growth in the state school fund, it was well above the 9%. It was more than double that as the dollars were being used to replace the lost property tax dollars. So you don't get a very good fit there. The key with 0103 under this plan would have been, did you have time to put any money in the stability fund? Because that's where you really needed it, was in 0103 and really in 0305 too. So if you're able to do that, then 0103, you'd be able to draw from that fund. If you don't have that fund, we would have dropped basically as we've done now, as we experienced.
Committee members, we're closing quickly in on the time when we're scheduled to adjourn this meeting. So in all the light of moving things forward, if please.
I move that there's 12 amendments to...
One more question? What do you...
I'm move that there's 12 amendments.
We're not in work session yet. We're still in public hearing. So we have a couple of people that are signed up to testify. We also have asked Representative Butler to help us understand the discussions that took place in the Revenue Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Tom Butler from House District 60. As staff has indicated, this has been an issue that we worked on diligently over in House Revenue and the Dash 12s, which you'll be working in work session a little bit later this morning, include the good work that was done by a number of the folks in the committee over there, and particularly our staff, including Cindy Hunt, as well as Paul Warner and others who have helped us. I want to discuss in brief terms the some high-level issues. This certainly is a change of the paradigm relating to school funding for the state of Oregon. When we put the general fund and lottery fund, the discretionary amounts, versus other sources, all Oregonians are subject to the personal income tax. And I think that's very, very important when we come back and discuss the personal income tax in relationship to all general fund sources or all sources of resources which the state of Oregon spends when it comes to the education. This recouches the debate over tax policy in the state of Oregon as well, so that as we discuss tax policy relative to personal income tax versus the state tax versus corporate tax, those kinds of things. When we talk about personal income tax is a very important portion of that. Let me just talk about the elasticity function of personal income tax, if I may. One of the things that you discussed in your discussions here in the committee up to this particular point dealt with things such as how much are we receiving back under the property tax, the local share property tax, and those kinds of things. Currently, there's a very small elasticity related to property tax. Elasticity, the higher the elasticity, the more volatile the income is. And we know that personal income tax in the short term can be very, very volatile, it's highly elastic. But from the long term, and this is one thing that I wanted to reiterate as to what our legislative revenue officer is telling us, is that for the long term, of all of the sources of general fund that we're talking about, personal income tax is the least volatile. It has the least amount of elasticity long term. That is, it has a regular upscale growth rate over a long term, much similar to that of, again, the personal property taxes that we also fund our education with. Among the less elastic, or highly elastic, that is a downward trend, and more volatile, are that of corporation taxes. The corporation taxes actually, over a long term, show a decline, as would sales tax, would actually show a decline. So the personal income tax over the long term is really the most logical place to change our paradigm and to change our thinking for the purpose of recapturing the discussion. And so let me also then just come back and touch base on a couple of the issues by establishing this at the personal income tax, 51% of the personal income taxes collected in the state, and then by using this the School Revenue Forecast Committee, $5.318 billion, and never allowing a ratchet off of that. So that still says, basically, folks, we're coming out of a modest recession, and we may not have the resources to fully fund education in this particular at the rate that the School Revenue Forecast Committee would like to have seen, which would include the current increases in the health costs, as well as the current increases in the PERS contributions that education would have to be making as public employees. but the 5.318 would then continue to grow as it uses basically a starting point in this, from this biennium forward. And that's why even under the forecast, the trend forecast projection that legislative revenues provided you, the 9% on the next round of 2007-09, the 9% growth does not come to the total of the 5791. The 5791 is all that would be available under this at 109%, but that couches it, that springs it off of the $5.318 billion. And then that 5.318 would have been 5.797, and that's the number that is used. It's not rebased each time, so that you would have a ratcheting effect downwards. And this, again, as staff has indicated, was one of the problems that we saw in the Colorado plan. Then relative to the excess portions, the one-third would go to the school stabilization funds, the successful school funds, rather. The successful school funds, we went back to the Department of Education. The language in your dash 12 includes that portion, how that would be used to allow for successful schools and using the best of ideas and helping those schools which have not been able to be successful as well. And then with regard to the two-thirds, which goes back to the Education Stabilization Fund, let me just reiterate this, and I think this is very important. Realize that if we were in the process, if we had, and let me just pull a number, if we had the excess in the 09-11 right now, amount that set aside approximately a total of $136 million using the figures that we have right now of additions to the Education Stabilization Fund, that $136 million would not be reverted into the Education Stabilization Fund, into the Measure 19 Protected Fund, would not be diverted into that fund until June 30th. And so if we were in the period of downward declining revenues that had not been projected, had not been forecast, then we would be able to reach out without a two-thirds vote and actually be able to expend the additional $136 million. It would only require 3116 and the governor's signature to immediately revert that back into education. And none of the findings are necessary. So we've got basically a Part A and Part B as we move to the Education Stabilization Fund and any excesses which will be available for that fund. And again, as we indicated, there's an opportunity to review this every 4 years, an opportunity to say what tax policy. And folks, we have discussed this again in revenue and recognize that tax policy would then be driven around, when we talk about tax policy, it would be driven around what would we do for individual income taxation if any changes, material changes, were affected as a result of federal or other kinds of enactments to tax policy relative to income, personal income taxes, then that would give an opportunity for a review, a legislative review. But also recognize that then Oregon could go out and attempt to draw in corporations and new sources of income back into the, and incent corporations and other new forms of income to the state of Oregon without going through the issue of what will this do to education, other than will it give us a springboard for the personal income taxes. To the extent that it gives us a springboard or an injection into the personal income taxes, then the 51%, which is dedicated then to the K-12 resources, would thus be affected. And colleagues, again, as I say, and there are other issues that you're going to be looking at relative to the Dash 12 amendments, including new stop losses for the high-cost disability grants and those kinds of things. Those are all very important. We've vetted those also in our.
Those are two very important components of this.
Absolutely, Madam Chair, and I just commend to you that the Dash 12 amendments include much good work by many folks and many committees coming to this particular point. I'd be delighted to try and discuss or offer any answers to questions.
Questions or comments? Representative Shoffler.
Thank you. You know, for an old hard-legged laborer, this is all very overwhelming because we're talking about all these formulas and stuff.
I think you're doing
well, thank you, Madam Chair. I was fishing for a compliment from you, and I'm grateful for that.
especially in light of my editorializing earlier. I don't even know if you have the answer to this question, but I want to boil this. We talk about these huge numbers that most people can't, including myself especially, just it's incomprehensible to imagine $1 billion, for example. I would like someone who's listening today to provide me with some numbers. Just take 5 or 6 school average from urban clear out to frontier school districts and tell me what kind of impact this would have on the people we're talking about. For example, teachers versus how many students, and then project it if that's possible. If we can historically show what we spent money on and where this would take us, because I boil everything down to real simple terms, and there's one simple term when we talk about this, I boil it down to, and that's my little girl, and how many kids are going to be in her classroom, and what we're going to do to help her teacher provide her with the best education America has to offer. That, I don't know if you can do that or not, but that would help me a lot if we could do something in that. And then, also, I wrote this down at the beginning. Where am I? And then the average we spend per student. I'd imagine that'd be pretty easy to come up with in any number of scenarios that we could project out.
And we'll try to have that information put together for you. And
thank you.
With that, I would like to call forward Chuck Bennett and John Marshall. And I believe Mr. Marshall is having a hallway moment, so we'll reel him back in here. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning. Madam Chair, my name is Chuck Bennett. I represent the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. Madam Chair, Ms. Marshall and I will split this bill up a little bit. I'm just going to comment on the portion that you've been discussing in some detail. You've gone into enough detail. I don't think we have a lot to add in terms of taking a look at this, except to strongly encourage you to advance this. This is an important bill. This is the first discussion we've had in many sessions of school funding. It addresses the three major issues that are facing K-12, stability, predictability, and adequacy. For next session, it clearly will be have a substantial impact on school funding. It allows local districts between now and then and into the future to plan, which has been one of the really missing elements. We have school managers who have not been given the opportunity to manage over time. They manage from crisis to crisis, which is biennium to biennium. This corrects that issue. Corrects that problem. It creates a large enough stability fund to deal with recessions in the out years. Is it enough? Does it meet all of the adequacy issues that we face out there? I would only point to a recent meeting held by members of the two Democratic caucuses here with school administrators in the past few months. When asked to stand up and talk about what the level of adequacy looked up, we saw people standing at 5.1, 5.2, 5.3, 5.4, 5.6, $6 billion. The number crosses a range, and I think it's one of the real difficulties in dealing with this issue, and we have the quality education model out in beyond $7 billion. So when we talk about adequacy, it is a long-term discussion about outcomes that, as you mentioned, Madam Chair, will be at least part of the discussion in the future. What it guarantees for Representative Schaffler's daughter, as mentioned earlier, is school will open, school will last for a year, and school will close. One of the ongoing problems we see in this current system, the bidding system referred to by the speaker, which we can only say has been less than satisfactory over time, is that we begin every session with the question, how many days of school will we lose? What will our classroom sizes look like? Will schools open and close at normal time? The whole set of issues, it's virtually a zero-based budgeting problem for K-12. This eliminates that problem. This is an important piece of legislation. It's an important concept. Are there issues that can be raised around? Certainly. Certainly. There are all kinds of issues on a complicated program like this. One of the things the speaker did in making her determination on how this bill is presented to you is to present it to you statutorily with reviews over time that allow for correction to occur in this bill. It can be corrected at any time if we find anomalies in it. This, again, Madam Chair, we ask you sincerely to move this bill forward and let the discussion of this bill continue. The Speaker has been generous with her time in talking with all of the organizations associated with education. Representative Butler created a work group that included every point of view so that we could discuss this, and there have been substantial changes from the original bill introduced by the Speaker in her press conference and in 3460. This has been a really well-worked bill, and it needs to keep moving. Thank you.
Mr. Marshall.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good morning. John Marshall, representing the Oregon School Board Association. When this proposal was first unveiled, I asked the question, how can we in K-12 prepare our students for a productive future when we're forced to view our own financial future in a series of two-year increments? And I might add two-year increments at best, since oftentimes the legislature makes its decision on the K-12 appropriation well in to a school year or at least a budget year. We have consistently had three goals in the area of school funding. The first is adequacy. And we've defined adequacy as how can we make sure that the investment the legislature and the Oregonians make in the K-12 system match the expectations we have for student performance. That is an ongoing battle. It was here when I arrived in this building. It's here now, and I'm certain we'll be here after I leave. The other one was equity, and that is even though we equalize resources amongst Oregon's 198 school districts, the question is how can we assure that those resources provide every student, regardless of the community in which they live or the school they attend, access to a quality educational program? I don't believe we're there yet. That battle is going on. And finally is the issue of stability. One only has to look over the last 4 years when schools were forced to make cuts during the course of the school year, five special sessions for the legislature to rebalance the budget after our economy tanked. And frankly, the last two checks the legislature wrote to K-12 bounced. And that's not meant to, in a pejorative sense against the legislature, it was out of your hands because of the economy, because of the failure of Measure 30 and so forth. So the question we're looking at today is one of stability and predictability. And I'm convinced, and my organization's convinced, that if you give schools the ability to plan for more than just 1 or 2 years, that we can do wonders. We can, the legislature will provide us the stability that we need from year to year rather than school districts trying to provide it for themselves through the use of carrying over cash reserves and so forth that create our own political problem for us, particularly when it's portrayed in the press as somehow rat-holing or squirreling funds. We're simply trying to provide the stability that we can't count on the legislature to provide. So we believe that this plan has merit, and we would encourage you to adopt the amendments before you and advance the bill forward. The two components that have been mentioned, if you have any questions about the details, I'll be glad to get into that, but both the Small School District Supplement Fund and the High Cost Disabilities Grant were components added to the distribution formula 2 years ago. We originally introduced 2450 to make those components permanent parts of the state school fund distribution formula because they help school districts with two fundamental issues. One is some assistance in providing services to the high cost or students with disabilities that are of extraordinary high cost, and the other is to try to provide some additional assistance to small school districts, particularly those that are trying to operate a comprehensive high school program in a very small and isolated community. So we think those are valuable components, and we're pleased to see them a part of the bill. Again, as Mr. Bennett suggested, we commend the Speaker for bringing this forward, for allowing us to be at the table to work on the details, and certainly Representative Butler and the Revenue Committee for convening a work group, and certainly, and additionally, the Paul Warner in his work in trying to do simulations and try to guess as best as possible what the future of our economy holds. And we're grateful to all of those folks for the work that has gone into this proposal thus far. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you taking your time to come and talk to us today. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2450 and open a work session on House Bill 2450. And the first order of business that we have here is to move the Dash 12 amendments into House Bill 2450. And I would take a motion to do that.
So moved.
I have the motion. Is there discussion on the motion? Representative Marks.
Madam Chair, I will not object to this motion, but I will be objecting to the main bill. I'll talk more then.
Okay. And then if there is no objection, which I'm assuming there is not, this motion is carried. And what I'd like to do now is just stand at ease and await Representative Krueger. He wanted an opportunity to vote on this bill. To House Bill 2450 as amended to the full Budget Committee with a due pass recommendation.
So moved.
I have the motion. Is there discussion on the motion? Representative March.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In looking at the both of these parts, but primarily the parts that are coming over from 3460, my main objection is the starting point where we're starting with schools at a general low point, and at least for my schools in my district. And we cannot attain anything near the quality education model with this as the basis, or meet the federal requirements of No Child Left Behind. And one of the comments was, school will open. Well, many in my district won't. I've already had two close. I expect more in the future. That's just in my district, and there's been more within the school districts in my area. Secondly, stability and predictability are fine qualities, but if the stability and predictability is at a very low point, sort of in the gutter, so to speak, then I think we're going to see a decline in our public schools. Secondly, is the second portion of this that I see in here as a problem is the 4.5% annual growth. Education costs, and this is per the Legislative Revenue Office that I was quoting from, going back to from 1948 to 1992, which was before Measure 5, so it didn't have the effects of Measure 5 causing changes. The cost never rose as little as 4.5% annually, and in many years they were double digit increases. So there's a problem there. Labor cost is projected to run at nearly 4.5% per year, not including the population growth of the schools. And so the actual education or even actual educational materials costs and things like that. So, I think there's two main problems with this, and one is the starting point, and the second is the growth factor.
Thank you. Representative Schaffner.
Madam Chair, I won't object to moving this bill. I reserve my right to vote no on full and on the floor, but I just want to get on the record on the days that Mr. Bennett or Mr. Marshall referred to when administrators and school board members were invited and came here to speak. There was a wide range, but the vast majority, if my recollection is correct, were 5-4 or greater, and some were, I think one guy said $7 billion, which we know we don't have. I guess my question to the two gentlemen is, and I sent out emails to my respective school administrators and school boards about this plan that we were looking at then. It has been changed. I'll give in credit to that. But I want to know if their membership has voted to endorse this plan or not, of the respective two associations. They don't need to answer it now, but that was going to be my question. But in light of time, I understand we'll move on. I will not object at this time.
Thank you. Further comments on the motion? With Representative March's objection noted, are there other objections? motion passes. We will carry this in the full budget committee and speaker minutes will come out soon. And with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2450 and adjourn the meeting.